We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Throughout the 1970s, the Morecambe and Wise show reigned supreme as the unequivocal jewel in Bill Cotton's BBC Light Entertainment crown. This was the ultimate peak of their popularity, and an audience of a staggering 28 million tuned in to watch the 1977 Christmas show, making it one of the most watched light entertainment shows of all time. Yet away from the glamour of television, the pressure would ultimately take its toll on Eric Morecambe, who continued to perform despite surviving two major heart attacks and ultimately led to his untimely death on stage at the Rose Theatre in Tewkesbury on the 28th of May 1984. Yet over 35 years since his death, the phenomenon of Morecambe and Wise remains at the beating heart of light entertainment. I caught up with Gary Morecambe to celebrate the nation's favourite double act who never failed to bring us much needed sunshine. Ladies and gentlemen, let's talk Morecambe and Wise.
We'll get on to Eric and Ernie in just a second, but it occurs to me that in the last few decades, there's been a developing fascination in obtaining first-hand accounts from some of Britain's much-missed entertainers. Why do you think this is, and what effect has this had on your own career?
Right. I think that a lot of interest comes about because we're a nation who thrives on nostalgia. And I think that maybe the most relevant thing in recent times has been the pandemic. So when something comes along like COVID, I think that we then look for comfort in things that are very safe and familiar to us. And we go back to, usually we do go back to the 1960s, 70s for family entertainment. And I think also with that in mind, there hasn't been an awful lot of good stuff like that ever again. I think that that was a bit of a special era. I think there are great stand-up comedians, there are great TV shows, but there aren't really the sort of Tommy Coopers or Morecambe and Wise's anymore. And I think that people, after all these years, recognise that. And it's just another thing that they can then therefore go back to and re-enjoy again.
Yeah.
And oh, sorry, you did ask, has that affected me? Well, to be honest, it hasn't, because really for way back, probably the last 15 to 20 years, well, 20 years actually, maybe even a bit longer, the Morecambe and Wise machine, as I call it, has been driving on relentlessly. So maybe other people have got more involved with it of late and looking at it again, but it's never gone away. It's been like a family cottage industry really for the last 20 years, and the last 5 years has been bonkers really, because we've had so many documentaries and there are so many things in the pipeline as well coming up. So it's great that, I mean, obviously it's great that what a testimony to their reputations that it seems to continue on that basis.
Your grandmother Sadie always came across as a supportive, loyal and determined champion of both Eric and Ernie. How pivotal was her role in the union of the double act?
Her role was huge, not only because she suggested that these two young lads team up, which she did, I think, during the war years between Birmingham and Coventry on the train, because they were always doing impressions as kids of Laurel and Hardy and Abbott and Costello and things. And she suggested that they team up. But then it became much, much bigger than that, because teaming up is one thing, but then Ernie came from a very kind of chaotic background. He had brothers and sisters, and his dad was in and out of work. I think it was quite tough for him at home. So he wanted to be out of the home environment and working. And so Sadie became this kind of figure that looked after both of them. It was like she had the two sons in the end, Eric and Ernie. So it was her care and her motivation and drive on their behalf, because she wasn't that interested in showbiz, that actually kept it going and right the way through until they were old enough to look after themselves.
Yeah. Jack Hilton was one of the most prolific figures in British entertainment during the 30s. As an agent in the early stages of their career, what could he offer Eric and Ernie which others couldn't?
Well, Jack Hilton was a huge figure because he was a band leader as well as an agent. So certainly with Ernie, he'd already spotted Ernie. Ernie was quite a child star before my father came into the picture. So he was already giving Ernie great work. And he was another one, a little bit like my grandmother, Sadie, who took Ernie under his wing. So he was protective of Ernie and had the capacity through having youth shows to get Ernie into very good positions of performing and earning a good career. And of course, Ernie's big break way before Eric came along was working with Arthur Askey, the London Palladium. So Ernie was a child star and a prodigy when Eric came into the picture. And then when Eric was there, he was a very generous man. And as long as they didn't give up their single acts, he was willing to let them, you know, do a few minutes of their double act, which was a good idea on one hand, but probably very poor material on the other. But it seemed to work, and his support was therefore huge. That A, that he was able to do it, and B, that he was then willing to do it.
Yeah. During the late 40s and 50s, variety bills took on an extra prominence in terms of popular culture. In what ways did this environment help to refine and nurture their act, and why do you think they were so suited to a variety audience?
Well, I think that, variety was at its peak, wasn't it, in the 40s and 50s, probably. And in those days, you weren't distracted that much by radio, and TV virtually didn't exist. So for Eric and Ernie, they totally honed into that, and that's where they wanted to work. Was you didn't have a job unless you could perform on stage in front of an audience. That's how it was back then. So that was a no-brainer in that sense. That's what they wanted to be, was a variety double act. The other thing was that they were therefore influenced by other double acts, you know, whether it was closer to home or whether it was ones we've mentioned, like Laurel and Hardy and Abbott and Costello. So that influence just made them into what they became. And then, of course, what happened is as the variety hall started to close in the 60s, early 60s, probably late 50s, actually, Eric and Ernie then realised that they had to reinvent themselves again. So, you know, they always try to keep ahead of the game, but variety is what made them, because treading the boards for all those years gave them the chance to hone their skills and become very, very capable when it came to, let's say, the bigger stuff later on, such as TV.
Yeah. So, following up over a decade on the theatre circuits, in 1954, the BBC offered them their first television vehicle, the ill-fated Running Wild, which spawned the now infamous newspaper quote. How did your dad use this as an incentive to better both their act and the people around them?
Well, I think when you're actually in the situation, I don't think you use anything too cleverly or think too much about it or overanalyze it. I think that the result of that, the fallout of that, was just simply, let's get back to what we do well and what we're accepted for. So within a week of doing that, they were getting a standing ovation in Manchester, you know, performing a live show in front of an audience. So I don't think that it grated as much as history perhaps sort of records. Although, yeah, my father was seriously upset about it all. I think he was mostly upset by the fact that they hadn't got control over the TV show, because they were there as newcomers. They weren't allowed to be involved in the writing of it, or the creativity of it. And it became very apparent in these early years, and it happened again when they moved to ATV at first, is that they only used Eric and Ernie on TV in a way that they felt safe. And to make it safe, they surrounded them with other performers and comics, so that their intimacy, which they did on stage so well, was never really analysed for TV. People just quickly hid that away. But that was what they were about, their relationship. So I think that TV, until they had some control, which came later, was always going to be a bit of a difficult one for them. But they did take something from it. My father would have said he took the one thing from it that he took was never to do TV again, which is ironic considering what happened. He's even in an interview, I think, with something I read, where he says, as long as we stay off TV, we'll be successful, which is hugely ironic, but considering what would happen, you know, 10 or 15 years later. But that's about it.
So throughout their career, Eric and Ernie formed significant professional partnerships, which helped elevate them to the light entertainment kings, which they became. In 1960, they left their agent, Jack Hilton, to join what was then the biggest showbiz agent in the country. How significant was Billy Marsh and the Grade organisation to Eric and Ernie's eventual success?
Yeah, well, they actually didn't leave Jack Hilton so much. They left Frank Pope, who had been their agent, really, in the 50s, because Frank was getting them great work until his side of the business collapsed and he couldn't get the other theatres involved. So Eric and Ernie had to really leave their agent then, Frank. And that's when they moved to Billy, because they knew that Billy Marsh was not only a big agent, but he could get TV. So once they got to Billy, that was fantastic. And Billy, yeah, he then was able to get the much more TV guest spots to begin with. And then eventually, you know, he worked with or convinced Lou Grade, ATV, that Eric and Ernie were worthy of their own show. So that was a big, Billy Marsh changed everything without a doubt.
Yeah, that leads on perfectly to Josh's next question. TV came calling once again in 1961 when Lou Grade and ATV offered them another opportunity, and this time it would work. With additional material contributions from a young Johnny Spate, how did Two of a Kind lay the foundations for what would become the Morecambe and Wise show?
Well, funnily enough, I'm not convinced it laid too many foundations at that stage, because what Two of a Kind was doing is that was replicating what they were doing in the variety halls on television. And at first, they didn't even get that opportunity. It took a strike by Equity, and they weren't members of Equity. They were with the Variety Artists Federation, which was a separate unit. So the Equity strike meant that all the other performers that were being stuffed into their shows as usual, they couldn't work, but Eric and Ernie could. So suddenly they wrote... Sid and Dick came in, but Johnny Spate as well, as you mentioned. Now we suddenly could get material that was specifically about Eric and Ernie and their relationship, which they'd been waiting for all these years, you know. And so then they could go out and show people what they did. And then that would have given them huge confidence. So I suppose it laid that foundation stone. It laid the stone that this is the double act as it now is. And, you know, we are a double act. We're not part of a big high production show. This is just us, and we have conversations, barbed conversations with lots of humour, and that's what they became. And then that would get another development, as we know, further down the line.
Hmm. For variety entertainers such as Eric and Ernie, one of the downsides of television must be that it ate up a lot of their variety acts, which they've been using for years. Two of a Kind gave birth to a piano sketch, which later became the iconic Andre Previn sketch from the 1971 Christmas show. But in their 40-year career, how often would they recycle and update previous material for a TV audience?
For the most part, that they didn't. But the time it all started to kind of implode on that one was when they got to Thames Television. And certainly at first, Eddie Braben couldn't move with them because he was tied to his contract with BBC. So they were using other writers, people like Barry Cryer, who were great, and it was all good stuff. But they were finding that there was a great shortage of material. So they started then going back to those ATV shows and rehashing them in a kind of modern setting. And I know my father hated that, and so did I, actually, because the thing is, you can't rehash things when you're getting older, because you just look like you're an older person rehashing something. When you're young and doing those things for the first time, it's great. But the only one that really, really came off, as you've already alluded to, was the Andre Previn. That really worked, because with Eddie Braben particularly, they added a new dimension to it, because in the original ATV version, and they did an album version as well, LP, and there was no Andre Previn. It was just Eric and Ernie was playing the Previn role, really. So to bring in that whole new dimension and then the big orchestra was fantastic. But I can't think of many other occasions where they did that with big numbers. Just one or two small things that they then repeated when they got to Thames TV.
Hmm. In 1968, a young Michael Grade, who was deputising for Billy Marsh, was invited out to lunch by Bill Cotton, which resulted in Morecambe and Wise swapping sides to the BBC. In hindsight, how significant was that lunch in the careers of Eric and Ernie?
Well, huge, obviously. I mean, I'm a big friend of Michael Grade, and we meet up, you know, quite a bit and have some lunch together, and we talk about these days with great sort of affection. But Michael, you know, he's a great businessman, and he wasn't going to let that opportunity go. He knew that Bill Cotton wanted them at the BBC, and he knew that by going to the BBC that they would get colour TV, that's what Eric and Ernie wanted, was colour TV. But obviously, Michael being involved, yes, it was changed everything, but as soon as he was involved, nothing was going to prevent it happening. So he would never have, you know, let them stay at ATV once he knew that Bill Cotton wanted them and could offer them a bigger show. Because Michael, you see, he was almost like a surrogate son to my father. My family have always adored Michael when he was, you know, very young, you know, before my time. So he was always there. So Michael would have wanted to have helped Eric and Ernie, let's put it that way. And as he said with his Uncle Lou, he was fine about it because business is business. Yeah. And Lou had to accept that. And that's how they operate, these people, you know.
Yeah. What we've probably failed to mention so far is the contribution of writers Dick Hills and Sid Green. At what point did they become integral to their success?
Well, right at the beginning, as soon as they got, in fact, Eric and Ernie were really keen to get Sid and Dick working, you know, for them, writing for them. And so once they were involved and once that equity strike came about that I told you about, Sid and Dick were then writing for four people, which was because for some reason they still wanted to put themselves into the sketches. I don't quite know why. But it was fine and it worked, you know. A bit unusual to have your writers appearing every week, but it worked. It was better than having 50 other people drifting around. So, their writing was excellent. And I think Eric and Ernie always recognised that. And they were able to stay friends despite, I wouldn't say a bitter parting, but a little bit. It was a bit unfortunate when they sort of separated company. When my father had his heart attack is when they separated. But it was a good working relationship. And again, it was another platform onto something that was really good. And by now, Morecambe and Wise were stars, but little realising that there was still another level, well, several levels that were going to go up once they changed the writer. I think that's the key. And you can't underestimate not just writers when you talk about this, but you've got John Ammons producing it and Bill Cotton still running as BBC head of light entertainment. So a team was going to be building later on, which was going to elevate them to a new level altogether.
Yeah. I believe that you were on an aeroplane when your dad and Ernie discovered that Hills and Green had left them. What was the initial feeling?
I wasn't on an aeroplane. Ernie was. Yeah. Ernie was on an aeroplane. And I think that is probably was the only hangover from their divorce between the writers and the performers, was that you don't really want to find out that your writers have left you via cabin crew on a flight. So it's not an ideal scenario. So I think that they felt thoroughly miffed about that. But the fact didn't it went, they totally understood, because my father, as he said, he didn't know what his health was doing at the time. So they were writers, they had to go and make a living. So that was fine. It was that they probably weren't courageous enough just to ring up and say, look, we've decided we're going to move on. And that would have been the really nice thing to do. They probably got a bit nervous about it, to be honest, and just slipped away or tried to slip away quietly. But you can't do that in this business.
Eddie Braben probably wasn't the obvious choice to replace Sid and Dick as a result of writing one-liners for Ken Dodd. After a lot of coercing from Bill Cotton, what was that moment when your dad realised the potential in his relationship?
I don't think my father realised it at all. He probably thought that Eddie was a very good gag man. It was Eddie himself that recognised that he could do something with Morecambe and Wise. And what Eddie saw was that he saw it at the meeting, not through any writing or performing. He saw two men who were, he said, closer than brothers and finishing each other's sentences. And he said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to work on their relationship and make each episode more of a story about them. So that's when he started getting the flat routine, the bedroom routine and all the rest of it. And Ernie being the frustrated playwright. He created this character, particularly Ernie, created a character around Ernie, and which then Eric could then bounce off. So what Eddie did, because Eddie never liked the ATV shows. Eddie said that no one could be that stupid as Eric was playing it, and that Ernie was a typical variety hall straight man, you know, slightly aggressive all the time and the rest of it. So he basically got rid of that whole Abbott and Costello feel to their double act, the traditional musical double act, and made them a relationship which turned into a kind of almost a weekly sitcom, really, because everyone looked for the flat and the bedroom routine. These two men, middle-aged men living together, you know. So yeah, he changed everything with Eddie. Eric and Ernie just went along with it because they were desperate to go on and make shows and hadn't got a writer. And Bill Cotton had recommended Eddie Braeden. But after the first show, they all knew that this was going to work now, that this is where it was going.
Mm. Read on Variety himself, Bill Cotton became a visionary for British light entertainment. In what ways did his shiny floor Hollywood glamour approach in programme making appeal to the ambition of Eric and Ernie?
Well, what changed everything there, and why Eric and Ernie? Well, Eric and Ernie both wanted the shiny floor effect because they'd both grown up on Hollywood movies. So they always wanted to incorporate that into their shows and then make it funny, you know, take the mickey out of it, really. But it was actually Bill Cotton sort of started out by giving them the whole big set, which was lovely. But it was Ernest Maxim coming on as choreographer to begin with, then producer and choreographer, that really changed everything again, because Ernest Maxim was a bit of a ham, like Eric and Ernie were when it came to the old Hollywood musical. So the three men then worked out that each show, well, not each show, certainly every Christmas show, would have a big musical number, which is why you ended up with Shirley Bassey and the Singing in the Rain routine and the dancing newscasters and everything. That was really because Ernest was there, and Ernest was able to choreograph it and execute it so well. So that was a big change. But that didn't really come until sort of into the early 70s by that point. So you had the first couple of years of the BBC, which were much more tentative, careful years. Eric and Ernie had changed because they had Eddie Braeden on board. But then there was still another gap, and then all the musical numbers came. So by 1975, Morecambe and Wise had reached their peak. They didn't really change after that.
Mm. In 1977, the Morecambe and Wise Christmas show attracted 27.9 million viewers, the highest rated light entertainment show of all time. Yet, unbeknown to Bill Cotton and the BBC, this was to be the last show with the corporation. How did Eric and Ernie feel about this?
On one hand, they felt very, very sad. But on the other hand, that all their career, they had worked it, that they didn't stagnate. They always moved on. And I remember my father back in 1973, so quite a bit before this time, saying that they were looking and thinking, he and Ernie, about doing something different, maybe not doing a TV series, but just having a sitcom about just them in the flat. And it never materialised. But they were creative people and they never stopped thinking. So the fact that they left the BBC was kind of inevitable, actually. And their reasons, I think a lot of people thought it was monetary, but it really, really wasn't, because the BBC would have paid them what they wanted. They were the biggest draw there. But it was because Thames TV had a film arm, I think Euston Films, and Eric and Ernie had never been happy with their 1960s rank organisation three films they made. They thought they were okay, but they weren't special. They still dreamed about doing a big movie. And they felt that maybe Thames, who were serenading them on that basis, could offer them that. Now, the tragedy of that is Thames TV had no inclination at all to make a great movie for them. They just wanted to use that to get them in, then give them a low budget, bit of directing, get on, do it, make it, finish. So it was a little bit wrong, really. I think that they were serenaded falsely on that one. Maybe they shouldn't have left the BBC, it's probably what I'm saying.
Yeah. At Thames, though, they continue to attract the big names and big audiences. But in the changing comedy landscape, how aware was your dad that times were changing and new TV execs may have had more bias towards the new phenomenon of alternative comedy?
Yeah, no, I think he was very aware of that. Although, funnily enough, it didn't really worry him because he had his own issues in life and he'd had a great career and he was already getting involved in writing. So I don't think it worried him. In fact, it didn't worry him at all, but he was certainly aware of it. I would dispute, though, that they had big names at Thames and that there were great shows. I think there was a limit there. I think that Thames were trying to repeat what the BBC were doing with Morecambe and Wise, but without the production values or the budget. So you didn't get people like Andre Previn or Shirley Bassey. You got the latest flavour of the month on ITV TV, and they would almost be kind of showing off, showcasing their own acts, which is, I don't know, I wasn't very happy about the Thames years personally, as you can probably tell. But I do think also that Eric and Ernie, just before my father died, as it happened, I think that they were having one or two secret chats with Bill Cotton again, and to go back to the BBC. So had he lived, the rest of it, I think they would have gone back to making shows at the BBC. But having said that, maybe by then it was too late anyway. Maybe the alternative scene would have swept everything away.
Yeah. Tragically, on the 28th of May 1984, Eric joined his good friend Stan Stennett at the Rose Theatre in Tewkesbury. Away from your own personal feelings of that night, how did Eric's death change the British comedy landscape?
Well, I'm not sure it did change, because I think, as you mentioned earlier, the alternative comedians were changing it anyway. So I think that what happened was he went from being a live performer to one that we remembered. And as is often the case when someone dies, you have this great outpouring of grief, and then they disappear. And Eric and Ernie, from 1984, when my father died, to 1994, were barely talked of or referred to or referenced in any way whatsoever. It's quite a strange time, actually. So I was living abroad a lot of that time and came back to the UK and there's nothing. And then a friend of mine, a colleague, Martin Sterling, and I, we decided to celebrate the 10th anniversary of my father's life and death by writing a biography. And at the same time, we were approached by the BBC, who wanted to do like a little tribute to Morecambe and Wise of their own, with Ben Elton introducing it. And it got something like 12 or 13 million viewers, which was extraordinary, even back in 1994. So suddenly there was that again changed everything. So since 1994 to now, they haven't gone away. But there was that 10-year hiatus where there was nothing.
Yeah. In an interview from... Josh said, why do you think that was? Do you think it was because there was upheaval at the BBC and the management didn't favour that style of comedy?
Yeah, I think that's true, Josh, to a degree. But I think also someone once said to me, a publisher actually, he said that when someone dies and they've been in the public eye a long time, there comes a period of reflection and things just go quiet. You know, it's a little bit like when Michael Jackson died. You know, there was this outpouring of grief, oh, it's Michael Jackson. But then nothing really happened for a long time. It's only years later, you suddenly get the musicals and all the rest of it comes out. But there's always, I think, just a resting down after any grief. And in some cases, of course, they disappear altogether. But I think Eric and Ernie's body of work was so great that that was never going to happen, which is why it's still back now. But yeah, I think that's why there was an initial, you know, quiet period, a hiatus, as I call it, because I think people just needed to quietly reflect. And then there was that level of you quietly reflect and then move on and then kind of forget. Now, you either forget and then make a comeback, as I say, or you forget and that's it, you're done. And with Eric and Ernie, it came back big time in 1994. And it took the BBC to bring back their own product, in a way.
Okay. Josh said he feels it's the same with Bruce Forsyth. Like at the moment, there's not been much made of his career.
Correct. Correct. I think that's very, very true, Josh. I think what makes it slightly tougher as well on some people that you don't hear of is that they don't leave such an amazing body of work. Mm. It's people like Roy Castle, like Bruce Forsyth, and even Des O'Connor. I mean, even if you gave them a good break and then went back to them, I'm not sure what you would show. With Eric and Ernie, with their Christmas shows, you got this wonderful piece of entertainment because the shows were crafted deliberately that you had your variety act come on, you had your opening bit in front of the curtains with them talking, you had your flat routine, you had your bed routine, you had a big star, usually an international star, with a big shiny floor setting and a dance routine. Then you had Bring Me Sunshine at the end to end it. So you had this amazingly well-crafted show that the BBC, ITV, Channel 5, whoever, they can keep showing them again and again. And there'll always be a family audience out there either enjoying it for the nostalgia or enjoying it again to show their family and say, oh, look at this. This is what we used to watch in the 70s or whatever. But it's quite tricky with people like Bruce Forsyth. You can't really show an episode of Play Your Cards Right or The Generation Game. It kind of wouldn't mean anything. Or Des singing a song on a show or something. I don't know. I don't know. Eric and Ernie were very clever that they made shows that are pretty timeless. They didn't get bogged down with the politics of the day. It was all about them and their guests. They created a world which is time-proof.
Yeah. In an interview from 2003, Bill Cotton said of Eric Morecambe, every so often someone stands on top of Everest. What do you think he meant by this?
I think Bill Cotton was a big Morecambe and Wise fan, even when they're at ATV. I think Bill just meant that someone comes along a little bit like Tommy Cooper, who just have funny bones and can do anything comedically and in a way that relates to the public, so that the public, it almost then starts to transcend comedy, so that you end up with someone who people just care about. I mean, when I think back to the fan mail my father used to get, there was hundreds of letters a week. The majority of them were more concerned about his health than whether he was funny or not, or comedy. You know, they actually cared about him as a human being, which is why you get that thing about when he died, you get everyone saying it was like losing a member of the family. Well, you know, that's how they see these people. And they're the ones that stand on Everest, as Bill Cotton says. They're at the top looking down because not many people get to that point of adoration, of, you know, love. It's extraordinary, actually. It is really extraordinary, which is why he probably picked up on it. Mm.
Despite appearances on The Wogan Show and the BBC Anniversary in 1996, Ernie chose to make few public appearances following Eric's death. In your opinion, was there public appetite to see more of Ernie during the later years of his life?
Probably not, because Ernie was always labelled a straight man, which was a little unfair because he was always much more than that. But I think Ernie chose not to, because I think Ernie was bereaved. I think that he might have been married, Ernie, but I think he was also married to Eric. And I think losing his partner at a relatively young age, 58, I think for Ernie, it was like a death that occurred. They'd been kids together and, you know, travelled everywhere together, travelled the world together as well. So I don't think Ernie ever fully recovered from that. And the more I saw of Ernie in his later years, which I did, more so than the earlier years, funnily enough, he always wanted to talk to me about old stories about Eric and Ernie. And when they were young, they did this and went there. And so I think that Ernie was happier in that space and trying to achieve anything in the then current space. I think he wasn't bothered. There was no need to. You know, he'd proved himself. Maybe he could have, in my opinion, he should have maybe pushed himself a bit and said, okay, I want to direct a film or something, or I want to have a go at writing a TV sitcom or something. I don't think he ever did that. He tended to keep very, very low key. But he had to do what he had to do. And without his partner there, it must have been very difficult for him. It really must have been.
Hmm. Lastly, what is Morecambe and Wise's legacy on light entertainment today?
Well, that's a big question. I don't know if I can answer that, really. What's their legacy? I suppose that they left us so many fantastic shows, a wealth of material, proved perhaps by the fact that they're still in demand and that there's still, as I say, some kind of cottage industry operating around the family, which is true. Without Eric and Ernie, I'd have to get a real job, which would be terrible. So I'm very happy about that. that's the best legacy. it's definitely their work.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.